Greetings, subjects. Welcome to the third and final chapter of Dune Month. This is House Gale Boys. I am Duke Liam, as always, joined by Baron Jordan.
This is going to be interesting because we've kind of made our peace with the movies. This is more of like a franchise retrospective, which is just saying Dune the franchise is kind of weird because you read those books, giant like space jihad and talking worms. How do you turn this into a video game?
Well, I mean, it's interesting when we get into it. So this is kind of our house cleaning of the rest of like major Dune media that we've stepped over. Primarily the Jodorowsky documentary, Jodorowsky's Dune. A little bit of the miniseries, the 2000 miniseries,
because
I rewatched a bit of it, and I've got some shit to say. We both have some shit to say. And just sort of...
Yeah, the greatest school play ever filmed.
What if Babylon 5 had slightly more of a budget? That's what I felt like watching it. It was very much like, we'll get into it before, but we're getting ahead of ourselves, and we'll kind of just do a... kind of a last house cleaning to close out this weirdo franchise. But before we get into that, let's get to the news.
I have a hug.
You dead?
So really the biggest news item, and I think this is the most proof America is fucking losing its mind and just kind of grasping at straws to hold power. They're going to ban TikTok for reasons that are pretty apparent to anyone who's like knows what's going on in the world, that this has nothing to do with what they're saying there actually has to do with.
Chairman of the ADL, which is basically just a pro-Israel lobbying group at this point, just caught on hot mic saying why this is actually happening. Even if you're not on TikTok, the number one trending thing is Free Gaza. That's why it's getting banned. It has nothing to do with the evil Chinese. It has nothing to do with fucking like brain rot, like Zoomer teenage brain rot. It's everything to do with this one app is turning like an entire generation against one of our proxy states.
Yeah, it's. I think it has to do a little bit with the Chinese, but yeah, it's mainly due with. I'll just kind of say my piece about Israel here. It's mainly due to the fact that the Free Gaza is trending every day on there. Also, the IDF loves posting war crime footage on there. Which it made me think.
Sure what if the Dela Banger Brigade from Come and See were fucking live streaming all their shit? That's basically fucking... Yeah.
It makes me think of that line from The Simpsons, videotaping this crime spree was the best idea we ever had.
Because
you know that it's all fun and games until the international court. It's the same thing happened with like Bosnia, which go in there with video cameras and film our ethnic cleansing, and now all those guys are in prison or in hiding.
You'd think Israel, which is like the Serbia of fucking the Middle East, would learn from that, but I guess not.
Unfortunately not, because as we've learned throughout doing this show, time really is a flat circle. But I really think one of the other big bugbearers of banning TikTok is, A, it definitely has to do with Israel-Palestine shit, but also America desperately wants a Cold War with China that China's not interested in having. We've seen so much of this with, like, this started really with Trump going really hard against Chinese-made products, and we learned recently he had a wing in his administration that whole job was basically just to spread misinformation about the Chinese government on social media. And America, they want a Cold War, A, because a Cold War is very profitable, and America needs the money right now. And they can't really have one with Russia anymore because a good majority of the people in American government really like Russia. So let's go after the evil Chinese.
You can't really have a like Cold War with Russia anymore. The like whole thing's gone to shit. So we need someone else. And I guess it's the Chinese now. The Chinese have like zero interest in any sort of conflict with the West. They're purely, please buy our cheap Chinese crap. Please give us money so we can like free ourselves from the wretched dollar system. Yeah, Trump started this off, but everyone, including the Democrats now, are just fully on board for this fucking bullshit war with the Chinese.
I really think it's America just needs to be constantly at some kind of war to stay afloat. It's been a thing forever in America, but yeah, it really feels now like it needs to be at war, it will die.
We joked about how America only makes like John Wick and Marvel movies. They also make guns and artillery shells, and we've got to use that on someone. And you know, Ukraine's drying up. Israel was kind of starting to flounder, so we need somewhere for the military-industrial complex to drum up support against. So yeah, this is it's gonna be great.
No, it's gonna be. But yeah, if they ban TikTok, if Trump runs on a pro, I will bring TikTok back, he'll win the presidency. Fuck Gaza, fuck all that shit. Run, I will bring TikTok back, the Zoomers will come out and vote for him as president. I'm almost guaranteeing that at this point.
Yeah, Trump, he bad-moved TikTok a couple months ago, but I can see him very cynically running on like a quote-unquote free speech platform. Yeah, vote for me and I'll save your precious TikTok from evil Biden. There will be a second cultural revolution if that does come about. Fucking like Joe Biden's gonna get struggle sessioned to death by a bunch of teenage boys that have never left their house before.
Even everyone who like used to kind of take their medicine, eat their pills with this kind of propaganda, it's not really working anymore. I've seen so many young people like talking about, yeah, this is totally about control.
Joe Biden, very much Emperor Shaddam the IV type character. He'll ban forbidden Exian technology while hoarding it all for himself.
Yep.
Ban this like forbidden shit. And who in service of Israel? This fucking floundering dictatorship, which we're like forced to fucking bend the knee to.
As soon as they spill American,
including you know a certain director.
Yeah.
Who gave a very interesting speech recently.
All right, so we didn't talk about the Oscars on this program because we don't give a shit. But if you go on the Oscars YouTube page, all of the speeches are there, makeup artists, cinematographers. There's one that's missing. Best foreign language, best foreign film. And that is Jonathan Glazer winning the Academy Award for Zone of Interest, where he went on stage and didn't play ball, as we could say.
All our choices were made to reflect and confront us in the present. Not to say, look what they did then, rather look what we do now. Our film shows where dehumanization leads at its worst. It shaped all of our past and present. Right now, we stand here as men who refute their Jewishness and the Holocaust being hijacked by an occupation which has led to conflict, whether the victims of October the 7th in Israel or the ongoing attack on Gaza, all are victims of this dehumanization. How do we resist? Alexandra Bistron Kaladziejczyk, the girl who glows in the film as she did in life, chose to. I dedicate this to her memory and her resistance. Thank you.
Really going off to the horrified gasps of all of the producers that we've read. You sent me this wonderful thing here. It basically conned a bunch of Zionists into funding this art movie.
He got half his money from like A24 and Film 4 and the other half from these like Russian Zionists who all went up on stage with him and fucking shit themselves when the director gave this very milquetoast statement about how Israel shouldn't be doing its own zone of interest.
Yeah, it's very milquetoast speech, but the response he got is nothing short of psychotic, I would say, because there are a bunch of people who say like he should have his fucking religious like status revoked, as if that's something you could just fucking do.
Everyone has a Jew card, and if you shit talk Israel, you have to hand it in. That's how most Zionists view the religion. If you look at the polls in Israel, most of them don't actually like believe in religious Judaism. Most of them are atheists. I saw some fucking TikTok recently about some guy in Israel talking about how, like, he doesn't believe in God, but he still believes he's, like, God's chosen. That is, like, the ideology of Israel. It's, like, the religion, the, like, religious aspects have been completely fucking hollowed out. It's all just apartheid shit.
It's something that we're gonna see. I mean, Israel's kind of already a pariah state at this point. Like, even more, like, I know in America it's all, like, hurrah, hurrah, but around the world it's starting to get a little... And it's so fucked up, like, the way that they have their hands in American politics as much as America does in their politics. Like, it's so just twisted. And my favorite theory that I've read about Netanyahu was Biden knew he was a genocidal maniac, but didn't actually think he'd go through with it. He thought, like, oh, he'll just toe the line, you know, give me, you know, endorsement here and there. Now he's, like, committing full-blown fucking ethnic cleansing, and they don't really know what to do. Because they can't just pull support because they look like total fucking hypocrites. So if we just do this standard, we'll get him out of power and have a peaceful election. Because apparently elections are just like, that just solves democracy altogether. Even though, you know, there are countries that have a full-blown dictatorship that have elections that don't matter.
I don't think the problem with Rhodesia was that it wasn't a democracy. I think the problem with that, like, places like that in apartheid South Africa were a little more entrenched than that. And yeah, that is, like, liberal Zionism. It's, yeah, we'll replace the bad Zionists like Netanyahu with the good Zionists, and everything will be fine and great. It's the fucking Lionel Hutz Imagine a World Without Lawyers meme.
It's ridiculous. Imagine if they do get him out. Imagine if he steps down, or they have to, like, kill him in covert op style. You think
that's like a running joke amongst Globe Emoji Twitter now, is that Biden's going to do some, like, CIA coup against Netanyahu.
I could see that. His poll numbers are so bad, he might have to pull some shit like that. Like, it's so fucked. But this is a continuation. It's just, we're watching horrors play out live on the internet, and there's nothing we can do about it other than talk about it and feel miserable.
Dispatch orders to your navigators. They are to depart our space and return the fleet to its homes immediately.
The Guild does not take your orders.
Tell them to look into the future.
I'm tired of talking about horrors of the world. Let's get into the goofy shit today. This is our like, again, as I said at the top of the episode, this is our house cleaning of Dune as a franchise, and this was a fun revisit because there's some fun nuggets I picked up from both of these rewatches and reading a little bit about some of the video games as well. But before we get into it, I remember you sent me a message that you had seen Dune 2 again, and you wanted to share some stuff.
Yeah, I went to the Science Center, which has Scotland's biggest IMAX screen, Britain's second biggest. The biggest is the BFI down in London. I went to go see this with a friend of mine, and I noticed little bits and pieces that I didn't catch first time round. The most noticeable is when Stellan Skarsgård is in the hot tub. He has, like, naked boy servants around him.
Yes.
And I know Villeneuve, he was kind of, like, not interested in portraying that character as, like, a, like, gay rapist. But you do see, like, little hints and pieces of it here and there, which I just noticed.
Yeah, no, it's also one of the things I noticed because I did see it again. I don't know if this was a COVID thing, but when I watched it again in IMAX, it might just be the aspect ratio. There's this weird thing where all of the stuff with the actors is, like, shot really close up, and then you have, like, extended shots of, like, spectacle. It's very weird. It's like you have tight close-ups of dialogue scenes, and then you have, like massive shots of spectacle. I'm not sure if that's a COVID thing or a style choice or just the aspect ratio, but it was very weird to me. Because the first Dune is pretty, like, there's a lot of, because that was filmed pre-COVID, and there's a lot of, you really get the sense of the scope and scale throughout those shots. It's shot, like, medium wide, whereas this was, like, close quarters shooting. So that might just be a COVID thing, but it was very weird.
I'd like to think it's just an artistic choice, because the handful battles here are, like, there's a million things going on at once. And the like scene towards the end when the sandworms are crashing into the Sardaukar frigates, that's like, you see everything.
Yeah,
like, this isn't like Star Wars or whatever, where you have like very close-up shots to action sequences. This is very like...
I was just saying, mostly through dialogue, like when we're out in the desert. It might just be an aspect ratio thing, because again, one of the things I noticed with the IMAX, it's not actually 185, it's 143. Which is, like, the last guy to shoot a major movie like that was Zack Snyder on fucking Justice League. But, you know, Villeneuve actually...
Yeah, that's what's so funny about IMAX, is that there's, like, two versions of IMAX. It's been called LIMAX now, because you don't, like, get the true experience. I know there's two IMAX, which is what Dune 2 was.
Yeah, no, it's very much one of those things where, like, I said on this the last episode, there are movies that really use the format well and those that fucking don't. That's the sign of a good movie, though. You can watch it more than once and you really get the... Like, you can notice things you didn't see before. And I think that's a, you know, that's a sign of a good movie. But enough talk of that. We're going to get into... I want to start with Jodorowsky's Dune. Jodorowsky's Dune, excuse me. This documentary... it's one of those documentaries... Like, I am obsessed with, like, stories of unmade movies. Like, you know, the famous one is, like, Kubrick's Napoleon... Or, I don't know, like, off the top of my head, Frank Miller's, like, unfilmable script for RoboCop 2 before Walton Green had to come in and, like, touch the shit up. But I just find the idea of, like, what could have been so fascinating. This documentary is like, the ultimate example of that. Particularly, like, when they open that coffee table fucking booklet. It's just, wow.
So one of my favorite what-ifs is Paul Greengrass's Watchmen, going back to that. That could have been... It could be so fucking good. Instead, we get the Zack Snyder schlock, which is not good. Yeah, but fucking I saw Jodorowsky's Dune when it came out, and I didn't really know who he was. I knew Dune obviously, but I don't really know him. I know him now, obviously. I've seen a bunch of his movies, but just the way he talks about this, he hates Dune, but also like loves it at the same time. He's basically doing like the Verhoeven Starship Troopers thing, which he'll read the book, hate it, but like the idea of it enough to like commit his body and soul into making a film about it.
One of the things I love about this, him when this documentary, how animated he is. He's like in his mid 80s when they made this, and he is so spry and so energetic talking about this movie that he didn't make like 50 years ago. And like he seems so passionate about it, but there's also like kind of a level of delusion involved with like how great he thought this movie would be. Jodorowsky, for those who don't know, he was a weirdo. He is a weirdo Chilean auteur filmmaker. He directed The Holy Mountain, which I think most people are at least aware of. El Topo, a bunch of other movies. But he is, his movies are like one of those things that they're like Gaspar Noé movies where it's hard to really like, if I were to sit down to describe The Holy Mountain, like what am I supposed to say?
It's one of those films that's like, it's next to impossible, because I don't think even Jodorowsky knows like what he was doing there. That's what I like about him as a director. He very much makes films for himself, and either you're on board or not.
I think it comes down to like, again, but like that's one of the reasons I think he openly says like he wanted this version of Dune to just be an acid trip. Because if you've read the details of this production, he wanted Pink Floyd to do the soundtrack. Orson Welles is Baron Harkonnen, which
one of the greatest miscasting opportunities of all time.
I'll just have him like drink that wine he did in that commercial.
Ah, the French champagne has always been celebrated for its excellence.
Sweet boys, come here.
Yeah, I like the story of how he got him. He went to some fucking restaurant in Paris and went up to Wells and like, look, if you do my movie, I'll get the chef to cook for you personally. How does that sound? And Wells, being the fucking rotund fucker that he was, like, yeah, sure, why not?
All Orson Welles stories I fucking love.
He's one of those people that like would ironically wear capes and shit. He's man, he's interesting. It's very funny that Transformers was his last movie. Like, he recorded that, then a week later he just croaks.
Oh, it's so fun. But yeah, Orson Welles. And then Salvador Dali as the Emperor, which Again, brilliant fucking casting. Like this, I don't know if Salvador Dali could act, but that would have been like one of those inspired moments of.
He's like been in movies, but he was never really like an actor. He was more just like an art house guy. His whole presence permeates other forms of media. He got kicked off set by the end of day one because he wouldn't stop making pro Franco comments, and that annoyed the mostly Spanish fucking film crew.
Yeah, Salvador Dali had like a weird history of kind of being pro-fascist as well. Like, Salvador Dali's, like, personal life is so fucking weird. You see his paintings, yeah. They could only come from a genuine place of madness, so.
Yeah, and it's very funny that he wanted, was it, like, 200 grand, like, an hour or something, and Jodorowsky was like, yeah, sure, whatever. So he filmed 2 hours. By the end of the movie, replaced him with some, like, dummy, some, like, fucking, like, mechanical dummy. I would flail around and shit. It's like, you know, genius.
Like, that's kind of one of the things that makes this documentary and this movie, like, this unmade film so fascinating. The level of, like, creativity versus practicality. You have all of these incredible fucking ideas and all of this, these things that Jodorowsky wanted to do. And he has no idea in any way how he would have done them. Like, how the fuck are we going to get Pink Floyd to do it? I don't know, I'll pay him. Like, you got to see, like, there's so many, like, especially with some of the special effects. So this book in this documentary, we get to see glimpses of it. And it's like a 300, like, page coffee table style book that they went across to, like, different studios trying to get funding. And the entire movie is storyboarded and you kind of get a glimpse of it through it. And it's just like, I don't know how you would have ever done half of what was in this book because it's... Some of these shots that they had planned were like, again, the mechanical Salvador Dali. How the fuck are we supposed to do that? And Jodorowsky's like, I didn't care. I wanted to do it. I was going to find a way, damn it.
Yeah, that's what's so interesting about what could have been for this movie. He got, like, very different artists to work on. So Mobius is a very famous French artist. Have you ever seen, like, The Fifth Element? A lot of his, a lot of that stuff comes from him. He was supposed to do, like, of the Imperial Salvador Dali shit, and then H.R. Giger was going to come on and do the Harkonnen stuff. Like, the Balanced Palace was just going to be the dome from Alien.
Yeah.
And I was like, this
that's partly worse. One of the reasons that's so fun is that a lot of these, and they see a little bit of this in the documentary, the end of the montage, the ending montage, where they kind of show, like, how this movie, like, all of these artists who came to work on this film and kind of dropped out, how they inspired other movies. Obviously, the Giger connection to this film and Alien is so fucking obvious. And there's also a little bit of Star Wars here and there. There's a bit of, like, Star Trek. It's weird. It's so, like, I mean, I it might just go into Jodorowsky's delusions of, like, what he thought this movie was going to be if he actually made it. Like, because there's a version of, like, imagine if he made this and it just kind of wallowed in the art house and, like, never really influenced culture outside of, like, a big cult following later down the road. It's weird. You never really know what's going to happen when you make a movie.
Especially with the cast. So my favorite is Mick Jagger as a fade. Young Mick Jagger as, like... He's, like, preternaturally handsome, and just the, like, the costume that Jodorowsky wanted him to wear is, like, goddamn.
Well, I mean, you see,
could have been something.
You see a bit of that in the Lynch film where he casts Sting.
Yes, Sting's fucking fong thing. Yes, that's the one thing he decided to keep. That's,
that goes into one of my favorite scene in this documentary is when Jodorowsky is dragged against his will by his children to go to the Lynch film. And he's, like, clearly pissed off. He's just so bitter. And there's this scene where he's talking about almost in glee.
It's a failure. Well, it's a human reaction, no? Because, it's not beautiful, but I have that reaction.
Thank you, David Lynch, for being miserable. It might just be his character, but he's a fascinating man in, like, ways that just... I miss when filmmakers had this level of passion. Because that's the thing about this, the takeaway from this doc that I love, is that even though this film was completely impractical, there's no way in hell, heaven, or earth this could have ever gotten made the way he wanted to. Even 50 years later, he is still so... He talks like, if I had to cut my arm off to make this movie, I would have done it. And you don't see that from any filmmaker ever now. that level of like just unbridled, I want to make this thing, I don't give a fuck what anyone says. I miss that shit. I miss that level of just fucking energy that just filmmakers now just don't fucking have.
If it did get made, it probably been a complete disaster. Because like, yeah, on page it looks cool, especially for like a 1970s film. It'd be like, no, I don't see like any scenario where this works. And it's like a good what if, yeah. But at the same time, I don't see your kids being able to put those. He trained his fucking kids, his son, for like 2 years to be fucking Paul. And then I can only imagine the fucking disappointment of him.
Well, I mean, also the strain that would put on their relationship. Dad would stop harassing me for 2 fucking years to do this movie that he's obsessed with making. Like, he put everything above, this movie was above everything. His money, his sanity, his family. It's like, this documentary is a great what if, but also like a view into a mind of madness that we'll never understand. And it's kind of beautiful. I'm not gonna lie, this again, impractical as fuck, but the passion is palpable, and it's something I really admire, even if the final product would have been a fucking mess.
It would have at least been like kind of visually interesting as opposed to what we're going to talk about next, which looks like a fucking stage play, the 2000 sci-fi series. Oh boy.
So I had never actually seen this until we decided we were going to do this, and I watched it. I watched all 4 hours of this, and yeah, it's 4 hours, which is it's as long as the Villeneuve film, the two movies put together. And one of the things that I really loved about this, I will say, like, the best thing I can say about it, it has that like late 90s, mid 2000s, like sci-fi TV show charm. Like the way it's produced, it looks like Babylon 5 or like Star Trek The Next Generation, where it's very clearly a TV production, but they're like giving it their all. I don't know, just if you've seen enough Star Trek or Babylon 5 like I have, then you watch this, you could really see that DNA seep through this, even though it's a Dune adaptation. That's probably the nicest thing I can say, because this thing is just... Wow, yeah, fuck.
It's still very funny that Deep Space Nine still somehow manages to look better than this, somehow. Oh, it's like, even though it was like literally like a decade beforehand. This was so interesting with the Sci-Fi Channel, because in the early 2000s, they were at the peak of their powers, because like it's the dawn of cable, and if you want to watch like Star Trek, the only place you could watch it is the Sci-Fi Channel. So they're just raking in residuals, and they decided to use that to make probably the most faithful adaptation of Dune.
It really
is. There's a lot of shit in there that, like, there's like I haven't seen in any other version.
No, well, that's the thing. Is like that's the weird thing about this adaptation. Is like, okay, first of all, it was written and directed by John Harris, who directed Tales from the Dark Side. He directed episodes of that show, nice. And he directed the movie adaptation. So he very much comes from a television background, and this has TV production all over it. Like I said, it's just the way, like, it feels big. Like, this show actually cost around $20 million, which is, for a Dune adaptation, pretty fucking small. And you can really see the systemic shortcuts that were made because of that.
Yeah, that's very much a green screen overload. I can imagine like half that money just went to the cast.
Well, I mean, also the guy who shot this fucking shot Apocalypse Now, The Last Emperor, The Conformist. Like, this is a fucking, like, one of the most legendary cinematographers of all time, and here he is doing a fucking 4-hour TV miniseries. It's so...
Like, that's what's so interesting about Dune as like an overall franchise, is that a lot of like auteurs seem to be driven to it. Like in the Lynch movie, there's a lot of like fucking Oscar winning special effects guys working on it, and here he's got like this dumb fucking sci-fi adaptation has got the guy who shot Last Emperor.
That's one of the things that was so crazy when I was... But I do think, again, Dune is... This kind of goes into, like, the theory that, like, any... I had this theory when Villeneuve was doing it. Everyone just seems to want to be a part of something that's, like, widely considered unfilmable, even if it ends up being inferior. The fact we even tried to adapt what it was years considered an unfilmable book is that's intoxicating, especially to like a later stage auteur guy like Vittorio, who, you know, I've shot for Bertolucci, I've shot for Coppola, I want to fucking do this just to say I did it. And but that's the thing about this show that's so crazy, is the fact that it is, like, again, it's so cheap. But the thing that got me is that William Hurt is the top billed actor in this. He plays the father of Paul, and he's in like the first episode and then just gets immediately worked and he's gone.
Oscar winning actor William Hurt, who is like very much the headline, even though he's only in it for like half an hour, and the rest are like either because this is filmed in like Czechoslovakia or something, or Prague or something, which is very much like a cheap old movie thing of the early
2000s. Oh
yeah. Okay. So it's like it's either William Hurt half like British character actors or half like Czechs, and then that like all the feminine are from fucking Prague and they don't even bother to hide the accent.
Oh yeah, no, it's it goes back to our Steven Seagal episode where there was this period like late 90s early 2000s where if you were making like a lower budget type of film or show, you would go to Eastern Europe. Like, that's why, like, Romania and Bulgaria was a popular destination to shoot movies for so long, because they were just so much free fucking cheap labor, and a bunch of weirdo businessmen would gladly give their business up to be in a movie or a TV show. And this has that kind of all over it. It's one of the things also is Alec Newman, who is the plays Paul in this. Now, he was a nobody at the time, but now he's like, he has like 4 dozen TV credits to his name. Like, this show kind of like blew him up. He's one of those guys who's like, you don't know who he is, but you read his resume and it's massive. And it's all like cable television or bit roles in movies. I love actors like that.
He does a lot of like video game stuff. He's very much like that guy actor. Like, you don't know his name, but it's like, oh, it's that guy. That is half the cast of this. Ian McNeice, who plays the Baron.
Yes.
As it's like a long-time British character actor, and he's very much like, oh, it's that guy, he's the Baron.
He's one of those things, I'm like, I've seen this guy in a movie, I just couldn't pin it down, and then I sat down. He was the warden from No Escape, the fucking Ray Liotta prison movie. I'm like just shit like that. Random shit like that I've watched. I'm like, yeah, he's in Ace Ventura, shit like that. But
he's in Ace Ventura too. I forgot about that. He's like the chaperone guy in Africa. Yeah, I fucking forgot.
I'm reading his credits because I love this. He is in Grizzly 2, the unfinished Grizzly sequel. Have you ever read about that?
I know all of it. It's one of those like another like could have been movies, because Grizzly is just a straight-up fucking exploitation movie, and they decided to make a sequel that just went nowhere.
Well, what happened was, it was like, just sidetracked, this is one of the funniest fucking stories that I ever read about a movie. It has a cast, I'm gonna read the cast list real quick. John Rhys-Davies, Louise Fletcher, Deborah Foreman, George Clooney, Laura Dern, and Charlie Sheen. This movie was like made before all these people got famous, and they like ran out of money because I think one of their financiers went to prison for something. It's fucked. It might be worth doing a whole episode, just a fucking episode, just to get into this thing. But yeah, no, that's just... Grizzly 2 is one of the funniest fucking things I've ever read about. But yeah, going back to Dune, there's so many like just weird choices in this too. And again, it might just be due to the TV budget as well, because that's kind of the thing. You don't have even with the Lynch film, for the runtime as short as it is, you have a lot more resources than you do with a Sci-Fi Channel series budget.
A lot of very weird choices. I sent you this thing yesterday of it's like Paul's won and he's threatening everybody. He's going to blow up the space field.
Yes.
And the fucking space in guilds, who's wearing like codpiece hats and shit, they approach him. The guild does not take your orders. It's like a lot of very weird fucking acting choices in this. My favorite is the guy who plays Fade in this is very obviously not part of that family, because you've got the English uncle, you've got like the Bistro Ban, who's played by a Czech actor, and then you've got like his American brother Fade, who is like very obviously like not part of that family.
You taught me that my own hands must always remain clean.
Oh, quick boy, very quick. You're good material, Fade, and I hate to waste. good material.
I do love also the they kind of make it's less like Islam and more like Egypt. Like that's part of the weird thing about some of the production design choices.
Yeah, there's the Harkonnens are dressed like Japanese, like Tengu warriors or something. They'll have these like weird like face masks and samurai armor. And the Baron floats around in a fucking like silk kimono. It's yeah. Like, what's the deal here?
The Emperor is like the Pharaoh of Egypt or something. It's so like, it's just one of those things where it's like, again, I think it's just TV budget. Like they used what they had. And I did enjoy watching this just for like the nostalgia of like, watching Babylon. Like, I tried to rewatch Babylon 5 recently, the first season, and some of those VFX shots are fucking god awful. They look like a fucking like 1995 PC game. And I kind of enjoy this at least. Like,
you were either like a DS9 guy or a Babylon 5 guy, and I chose DS9 because that's like the vastly better show.
It is.
Oh boy, I've heard like from like quote unquote dude enthusiasts that because this is the most faithful version up until now, it was the best. I was like, nah, not really. No. It kind of has this like. At the time, 20 million is not something to sneeze at, but it does look like the sandworms. The sandworms look like something out of a fucking PS2 game.
Yeah, no, it's just, that's the problem. Regardless of your money, you're still working with TV-level limitations, you know? We think of TV budgets now and they look like fucking movies, whereas back then, TV and film quality was so jarring. Like if you watch like a movie or a TV show around the same time, watch an episode of the TV show The X-Files and then go watch the 1998 movie, and the quality is like ridiculously jarring in terms of how much money they both had. It's
interesting because I've seen Children of Dune. I've got both of them on Blu-ray, and Children of Dune is like it's not only is it less embarrassing, but it's also like vastly better in terms of quality.
Yeah.
You've got fucking speaking of like early starts, James McAvoy is Leo 2, who's like running around with Matrix powers. It's very amusing.
I don't mind the Children of Dune adaptation, primarily because it was like, when we think of Dune adaptations, we always think of them trying to adaptate the original book. So it's all kind of all being influenced by the same thing. Like either it's the Hodorowski or the Lynch film or things like that. Whereas Children of Dune was not primarily circulated among those circles. So it is fun to watch like a different group of people try to adaptate one of the lesser known like sequels to Dune. And I think that makes it kind of more interesting. They don't have a pre-worked canvas like you do with any other Dune adaptation. So it does make for an interesting viewing experience.
That's why I ultimately like about them. They are very much their own thing. There's not even like any hints of Lynch's version and that miniseries. It's very much its own thing, and I do admire that. And then you get to the weird 90s video games,
yes,
which are like,
oh, I want to get it.
They use the costumes from the Lynch movies.
The RTS games are fun because I love when like people got into weird nerd shit primarily because it was an RTS game, because RTS games are maybe the least accessible genre of video game outside of maybe like hardcore role-playing games, like not like casual, like I'm talking like Ultima and shit like that. Like these, like I've tried so hard to get into RTSs. You ever fucked around with an Excel spreadsheet? That's what it's like playing a fucking RTS game. It's all clicking shit and moving shit. It's weird. It's not a particularly fun experience if you don't know what you're doing.
RTS games are very much like the black sheep of video games. It's not like Call of Duty where you can just like pick up and play and drop any type. RTS games require like a lot of like time and attention. And if you fuck up, then you have to like redo the entire thing. I'm playing Dune Spice Wars just now on Xbox, which is very much influenced of with the Villeneuve movie. It shares like a lot of aesthetics. You have to micromanage a lot of shit, and if you're not into that, it's completely inaccessible.
Well, I mean, particularly like 90s RTSs, where you have Dune 2000, you have Doom 2, which Doom 2 is the one that was very, very famous, 1992. It was a huge, like, it was like one of the original, like, real-time strategy games. It predates Age of Empires, Command and Conquer, StarCraft, shit like that. So it is very important to video game legacy, and it's an interesting experience to kind of play the pre. Like, I did decide to get an emulator and try it out, you know, because those DOS emulators are very easy to get a hold of, and they can run pretty well. So I tried it, and it's kind of fun to be like, all right, like, imagine being, it's 1992, you're sitting in your parents' basement, you just watched fucking, like, Basic Instinct, and now you're going to play Dune 2. It's an interesting experience.
When people think about RTSs, it's very much Command and Conquer, whereas Dune 2 was like, that was the first one. That was very much like, yeah, you're top-down, you're micromanaging little guys, you're base-building, capture command points and shit. Then by the time you get to, like the other Dune games, like... I was actually rewatching the fucking FMV cutscenes from the two Westworld Dune games, and fucking you brought up John Rhys-Davies earlier. John Rhys-Davies is in like the first one. He's playing like the Atreides Mentat. That's fucking like, it's like House of Cards. They're talking to the player and shit.
The Emperor has come in force this time. Even with the Fremen, we are outmatched. Our critical outposts have been divided, yet both must be reinforced and protected if we are to succeed in this final battle. We must fight until no Harkonnen breathes Arrakeen air. And with what troops we have, we must destroy the Emperor's palace. The Parisha Emperor must be brought to justice.
I love old fucking FMV cutscenes.
When people think about FMV stuff, it's usually like Night Trap. Very like self-aware cringe shit, but the reason why the Dune like cutscenes work and shit in both games is that not only do I have like prestige actors like fucking Michael Dorn is in the second one, he's the fucking Duke of the Atreides faction, they're taking it seriously, like there's a lot of like goofy shit and stuff, like everyone's taking this seriously, and that's the charm of those games.
Well, I mean, it goes back to like Wing Commander, having an actual budget and actors who give a shit helps, and then, you know, but I do think that those old FMV do have a lot of charm. I fucking Ground Zero Texas is my absolute favorite. If you don't know, it's a FMV shooter written and directed by the guys who did Halloween 4. So if you want to see a bunch of slasher bros try to make an action movie for the Sega CD, it's definitely worth a look.
Back when I had a like PC that could actually play games, I did play the Dune RTS games, and it's interesting because you have the Atreides and the Harkonnens, obviously. We have like different styles of play, and then you have this third faction from the Dune like encyclopedia or something, and it's interesting seeing like different stuff that's not in the movies like added to shit, like in Dune Spice Wars there's a lot of like cursory factions that like only real Dune heads know about are playable in this.
Dune is one of those things where, like, again, this on the surface level, you think, you know, the Atreides and the Harkonnens, but if you've listened to this mini-series we've done, how deep this shit really goes. And it's like it's like Star Wars, where, you know, the character of, like, Walrus Man actually has a deeply complex backstory.
Grub Shuttle or whatever,
that no one fucking knows or cares about, and but particularly with Spice Wars, I didn't actually play it. I'm aware it exists, but because I think Dune now becoming a bit of a mainstream success would lead to like a revival, or like someone would like remake Dune 2000 again or something. Like, there's potential.
Yes.
RTS games are like a very dedicated fan base. Go look up how many mods there are for fucking Hearts of Iron 4 or Crusader Kings. Like, they have deeply dedicated fan bases that could do some fun shit with this.
Hearts of Iron 4 is fun because you know, you can get your Nazi mod where Hitler wins and takes over the world. You can get your like base tanky commie mod where Stalin keeps pushing fucking west after World War II. They're very much tailor made for like specific types of people. Whereas here you're stuck playing like five different people. It's Spice Wars is very much like a successor to the old RTS games. It's if you've got the time, it's fun. Yeah. And also you can play as old man Christopher Walken with his Sadu car, which are like the best fucking unit in the game.
They just
kill everyone immediately. Yeah,
the Sadu car shot. Are like fucking a force of nature, so it's definitely a Yeah, no, I'm aware it exists, but the Dune is a... And Dune, we're actually seeing a revival of Dune games as well, not just in RTS, but there was an announcement of that open world RPG that they're making, Dune Awakening, which I like saw ads for like right after I went to go see. I feel like my phone is stalking me because right after I go see Dune 2, I get a fucking ad for this game that I've never heard of. It's like, here's a Dune an RPG that's made in Unreal Engine 5. And I'm curious to see how it would do because I think it's in early access or it's still being made. But I think Dune would work best as like either an RTS or like an open world survival RPG.
It's from the same people who did Age of Conan, and that's like, yeah, survival game set in that world. Yeah,
I fucking hate Age of Conan.
Yeah, it's, I could never really get into that, mainly because, like, I wasn't a Conan head. Like, I like the Schwarzenegger movies, but I was never, like, into that world. And it's like, yeah, sure, whatever. Whereas Dune, it does seem interesting. You know, I like the world. I don't like the premise of it. You can get, like, superpowers and shit. It's like, this has some potential here.
I just hate MMOs. I just find them incredibly... I just don't like playing them. Because I like to enjoy these kind of games on my own time. I don't really want to have to worry about people coming in and, like hazing me out in public like I've had with some RPGs. Like, I've been playing, like, Red Dead 2 online... And how much fucking shit I've had to deal with from random fucking 15-year-olds with mama's credit card information that'll just one-shot me. It's fucking frustrating.
That's why I like about GTA 5 online is you can just set up your own private lobby and not have to worry about 13-year-old people harassing you. I kind of hope we get, like, private servers for Dune Awakening. Playing with other people, that seems like it would be fun for 5 minutes before it gets, like... fucking tedious, but
This used to, everything we just talked about used to be just like in the realm of like random weirdos or movie heads or video game heads.
Yeah, Dune used to be fringe shit, whereas now like it's become the franchise, you know, De Laurentiis, what RIP to real one, wanted it to be. $1 billion franchise that's going to get like games and comic books and a bunch of shit attached to it.
And as we kind of continue with the previous episode we did, that has the potential to be very good or very bad, depending on who gets involved and what. I'm excited, and I'm also fucking fearful about where this goes.
The thing about being a Dune head is a lot of the bad outweighs a lot of the good. You know, if you got your six good Frank Herbert, you know, and then you have, like, 20... fucking awful Brian Herbert novels. Like, I tried to be reading Sandworms of Dune recently, which is like canonically the last one, and it's borderline unreadable. Like the way fucking Chapter House ends, it's very much like, yeah, a bunch of guys in a field, some ominous threat is approaching, but Frank Herbert didn't really, like, elaborate what it was, and then his fail son is like, oh, it's the machines. We're just doing Matrix shit.
Yeah, and that's the problem. When we run out of Frank Herbert material, we have to go to Brian, and it falls apart. As soon as Chapter House, if that ever gets made for whatever reason, just end it there, because it goes downhill. No amount of Oscar-winning screenwriters could salvage this shit. It's so... Yeah, there's only a finite amount of material of Frank's that's available.
Yeah, you could just end it there. You don't have to resort to, like... The almost fan fiction, Hunters of Dune, which takes place after, starts with like all your feet, like everyone comes back as a fucking clone. Like Paul's back, the Baron's back, and
it's
what the fuck are you doing,
it's
man?
It's the Lethal Weapon 4 of Dune, where it's just there's every. It's just one of those things where it's like,
yeah, all your fans are back.
We've run out of ideas. Let's just do fan service for a fucking 600 pages.
That's what's so fucking tragic, because like after God's Emperor, like when fucking Leo 2 dies, that's the last of the Atreides. We've got Duncan Idaho there, obviously he's your through line, but like the one after that, fucking Heretics of Dune, has an entirely like new cast of characters. And then fucking Brian comes along 2 books later. I was like, no, fuck that. We're bringing Paul back. We're bringing his Desert GF back.
Yeah. It was very much like, again, I think it was just desperation. I think one of the problems, again, this goes back to, kind of continues why I think franchising is a problem. Dune doesn't have a definitive ending Like, we think back to, like Lord of the Rings or fuck even Star Wars. Those have a definitive ending, regardless of, like, how many other, like, things follow it. That author told his story. He finished it. It's been told, and it's there for you to enjoy. Whereas Frank didn't really get to finish his story, so now you're left with, like, the end of Chapter House, where it's just like, what the fuck happens now? And you're just left with a forever what-if question, because Frank didn't leave any fucking notes, didn't really expect to die when he was writing this book, so you're kind of just sit left there holding a fucking bag. You're like, okay, shit.
Did the end of fucking Sandworms of Dune, it's literally like the clone of Paul and Cheney. They're like looking out into the sunrise and everything's fine and good. Did you read your dad's books?
That's why.
Did you like bother fucking like learning anything from him?
That's why I really believe Frank left no notes, because if you've read Brian's books, there's no way in hell, on earth, or heaven he read those books. I really do think just you're not gay, son. Write my continue my legacy, even though the other son probably is a much better writer.
I kind of like the meme that he set his son up to fail by not leaving any notes. It's like he's on his deathbed, Citizen Kane style. Finish my work, okay? You got any notes or drafts for me? No.
And then he drops the snow globe and Brian's just sitting there scared shitless, like, no!
Yeah, he drops the like an empty manuscript for Hunters of Dune. Just was like a fuck yeah. That's a snow globe,
it's
yeah.
Just 800 blank pages. Like, that's it. 800, just a stack of 800 blank white pages of paper. Like, fuck!
Yeah.
I think that's also, no offense, hateful people tend to have limits when it comes to making art. That's kind of the problem. If they do make great art, they don't last particularly long, or at least like their legacy kind of gets fucked up, especially like, you know, it's just something I've noticed.
I've read some quotes from Frank Herbert, and he wrote Dune as very much like a fuck you to JFK. Paul Atreides is like, that is his version of JFK. He's like this charismatic guy that everyone likes at the start and then just becomes a tyrant at the end. It's very much,
Then the thing happened with JFK. What do you think his reaction to the assassination was?
Probably the same as Al Pacino's in The Irishman.
Sitting, eating fucking sprinkle. Where's my sprinkles for my ice cream?
Jesus. Well, I think that will conclude
for our Dune retrospective. This was a fun month of just watching and reading some of the most weird shit I've read in a long time, and a good time doing this. But I think honestly, we can't read the future, but it'd be very interesting to see, like, Dune is, like, now that Dune has become a mainstream favorite, like, what will happen? It'll all depend entirely on who's involved and what. Because I would like, though, as much as I love that Villeneuve's in charge, I would like to see him kind of go back to, like, doing, like, smaller movies again. I don't want him to fall down the trap like Peter Jackson did or Robert Zemeckis did, where they were, like, they made these great small films, they did, like, these very successful big movies, and then never really escaped that. I don't think Villeneuve is that poisoned by the machine yet to do it, but you know, you never know. Peter Jackson, like, after he did Lord of the Rings, really, like, fell off, and just now he does, like, weird documentaries and shit for streaming.
That is the good timeline. Like, Villeneuve does Dune 3 and then just goes back, like, he does Sicario 3 as a much smaller movie. That's the good timeline. But I am concerned that, like, Dune just becomes the new Star Wars. It just becomes this, like, thing that never ends and just, like, grows increasingly shit over time.
Yeah. Speaking of Star Wars,
oh, boy.
I would like to, that kind of gives a teaser for next month, because I like this idea of doing, like, month-long retrospectives on different franchises, and I rewatched a certain movie that really, like, kind of made me realize we have to do this, because strike that iron while it's hot. And it's funny, because the franchise we're going to cover, I kind of gave it away, but it has the opposite problem, where the creator just wants nothing to do with it, and you get to see it fall apart in real time. Unlike Frank Herbert, George Lucas has to watch this shit happen while he's still alive, and it's genuinely... Mm-hmm. But that gives a teaser for the upcoming series I'd like to do.
Let's say without this franchise that we just talked about, the next thing we're talking about would not exist. Anakin Skywalker is just Paul Atreides. His story arc is next identical.
Oh, it's the same thing with Sand, too. It's the exact same fucking thing.
Yep.
That's kind of the takeaway to really hammer this home. Frank Herbert, it really is the godfather of modern science fiction. Love or hate him as a human being, he influenced, next to Gene Roddenberry, he influenced so many fucking writers and creators that he really hasn't gotten the genuine like respect he deserves now as a writer. And I think that's, you know, I think that's A, due to the fact he's an asshole, but also like, that's just how fringe this shit was until now. And it's always fun to watch the new people come in and just glom onto it and see what we get.
Star Wars was very much like an immediate hit, whereas Dune kind of had to take a while to get to where it is now. So it's going to be interesting, like, comparing to the two. We're going to be doing, like, a three-part Star Wars series, and the first part will be very much like George Lucas is, like, he's on one. Like, I don't know what he was sniffing when he made those fucking prequels, but I kind of want some.
Oh, that's the problem. He wasn't on drugs. That's the fucking insane part. When we do this...
He really is like the bizarro Frank Herbert. Frank Herbert's like a habitual fucking drug user. He's getting like warm visions. And George Lucas, he's just some like weirdo. He's just some like weird nerd.
Until then, stay safe, stay happy. Don't drink the worm piss and just have a good day, everyone.
Worm piss.
The mystery of life isn't a problem to solve, but a reality to experience. A process that cannot be understood by stopping it. We must move with the flow of the process. We must join it. We must flow it.